be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, and The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
And you had an endowed chair at Penn State University, so you clearly know the place. It was particularly disturbing the other night, Henry Giroux, to watch students overturning press vans and demonstrating on behalf of a football coach who had clearly failed in his moral and ethical duties. At the same time, up here in Berkeley, students of the Occupy movement were being brutally put down by police for demanding social justice. So just when we were starting to feel encouraged that the young people in this country were getting some political activism and standing up and reviving what seemed to be a long extinct campus activism, then we see the ugly side of it. So what's your takeaway from that?
Well, I think there are a number of things to say about this. I mean, I think that at one level we need to recognize that students are often the function and the product, although they mediate these places, of particular kinds of formative cultures. And I think that what we see in Berkeley and in New York City and Oakland and other cities, you see cities with very vibrant public spheres where young people are engaged in rejecting the separation of economics and ethics, who refuse this kind of neoliberal regime and machine that wants to commodify, deregulate, and privatize everything. I mean, they're concerned about their future. They're concerned about social issues. At the same time, you would think that universities such as Penn State, which really one of the few remaining public spheres we have left, where people can actually engage in thoughtful dialogue, you would think that an institution of that sort would actually encourage this type of critical engagement and thinking and literacy in young people. But I think that what we saw at Penn State is symptomatic of a lot of universities in this country, in that they're suffering from a crisis of legitimation and a crisis of politics. I mean, I think that many of them are now so inundated with corporate money and big money and military funds, military money, that they've become playpens for sort of private donors and private interests. And I think that they're largely managed by a bureaucratic class of administrators who are really not concerned about empowering kids. And I think that what we saw at Penn State in terms of the students demonstrating was an indication of the growing culture of illiteracy, civic illiteracy, that these places are producing.
So in terms of the culture of silence and the long protracted cover-up, it would seem to me that there was a very cynical reason for this, and that is that they sort of waited until this Coach Paterno got this broke this record, and suddenly everything sort of flooded out that had been going been around literally under the table for almost 10 years.
We know it's been going on since 1998, because in 1998, I mean, there was a charge made by a student. A mother brought a charge against Sandusky and actually went to the police. The police basically investigated it, claimed that there was no reason to charge him. The district attorney, all of a sudden, a few years later, went missing and never found his body. And he was known as an attorney that was very vigorous in challenging these things. I mean, I think to go back to the original question, the other side of this is that, remember, you know, these kids are underprivileged kids. I mean, these kids are kids who, from what I now understand, some of whom were black, and of course poor. I mean, these are kids that in this society a lot of people don't care about. They're undervalued, and they're underprivileged, and they're seen as excess. They're seen as disposable. And I think that what we saw here is a perfect example of an institution that simply turned its back on kids. But I also think in the larger scenario, what Penn State represents is a war on kids in general. And we see it happening everywhere. I mean, while the question of the specificity of sexual abuse is enormously important, and nobody wants to underestimate this, at the same time, remember, if you extend this notion of abuse to children, you see it everywhere. You see it in the homelessness, you see it in the poverty, you see it in the increased reach of the criminal justice system, touching kids in schools, which are now modeled in many ways after prisons, and you see it in the increasing sexualization of kids in the media. So we really need to connect the dots on this and try to understand what this is about. And if it wasn't taken up in 1998, it's because it's become so normalized in the culture, it's not very difficult to see.
Well, there seems to be a kind of cruelty now in the political debate that's almost incomprehensible, particularly on the Republican side, manifested in the debates, in the most recent one indeed, where Michelle Bachmann is on this jihad about food stamps, and she said that people shouldn't get people who don't want to work shouldn't be fed. I mean, you're talking about kids. I mean, she wants to take it a lot further than depriving kids of education.
I mean, look, think about what's happened in this culture. I mean, you have a form of casino capitalism at work that really represents a form of economic Darwinism. I mean, it's basically an utterly survival of the fittest logic. And what it does, it not only, in a sense, undermines and destroys the public state, the social state, and all forms of social protections, it privatizes all problems. I mean, it seems to suggest that if there's any problems at all in the world that people face, that these private troubles can't be connected to social concerns. So people have to bear individually the responsibility for problems that, in fact, they're not responsible for. Somebody's jobless, and you have, you know, almost 20 million people without employment. That's not an individual problem. But even worse, with this system of cruelty that's now mimicked every day in reality TV and extreme sports, the issue is not just saying that people are responsible. The issue is now saying those who are considered disposable, excess, or who, in a sense, are seen as dependent, now they're treated with scorn. Misfortune now is not just a liability. It's actually worse than that. It's an insult. I mean, this is what you get in authoritarian societies. I mean, what you get are two things. You get people who see democracy as an excess, and you see people who believe that there are groups that not only should not be in that society, but should be punished for it.
Again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, writer and current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, and The University in Change, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. So given the coarseness and hardening of our society and the cruel streak that's manifested, particularly from the Republican candidate running for president. The idea, of course, is that universities used to be a little island in its original concept, where students could have the freedom to be given a broader, more humane education that was rooted in ethical values and moral responsibilities, and then they go out and face the tough world. What you're saying, Henry Giroux, is that the kind of survival of the fittest corporate slash and burn nonsense that they teach at Harvard Business School and Wharton, that's invaded the entire academic culture?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely. I mean, certainly there are schools. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that every school is so utterly dominated by this logic that there's no space for resistance or there's no space for people to be able to do critical work. That would be nonsense. But I think far and away, I think it's pretty fair to say that the democratic university has given way to the corporate university. And I think in many ways, even when those universities did not always fulfill those ideals around either access or what they taught, or around questions of marginalizing kids who were poor and black and brown, still at least they saw themselves as basically democratic public spheres in some way engaged in the possibility of promoting and creating a formative culture that could enable people to be critically engaged citizens, kids who could learn how to govern and not simply be governed. But I think that's changed. I think that's rapidly changing. I think the university has lost its public mission. I think the university no longer takes the question of public values seriously. And I think the university, in a sense, has turned its back on addressing those urgent and most important social issues that any university should address. That's exactly what universities should do. We don't educate kids simply to be workers. We educate kids to understand what it takes to be able to, in some way, deepen and meeting the very foundations of democracy itself. Otherwise, the universities wouldn't even exist in a way that would speak to those issues.
So, but surely, Henry Giroux, that this is this decline of civility and education in its traditional sense it has to do surely with the cutting the education budgets. We here in the state of California had only 30 years ago one of the greatest education systems in the world, and it's been gradually defunded as we built these massive prisons. So it's obviously had its an effect here at UCLA, for example. The regents and the chancellor spend all their time raising money for big buildings with people's names on it, and you've written that universities are surrendering its mission as a democratic public sphere where the kids are taught to think critically and hold power accountable. But instead, what we've got now is universities full of managerial clones grubbing around for corporate handouts.
No, don't get me wrong. The funding crisis is very real. But I think if you want to understand the source of that funding crisis, you have to go back not just to simply inequitous tax structures. You have to go back to a neoliberal regime that began in the 1970s that attacked all things public, and in doing so attempted to disinvest in all things public. Universities are failing and are underfunded, not because they're public, not because they're not working. They're being underfunded and defunded because they're public. That's precisely why they're being defunded. They're being defunded because they represent what I might call a crucial element of the public good. And you have to understand that what the tax codes do and what these budget cutting policies put into place is exactly an ideology that for years has said, look, we need to privatize these places. We need to open them up to simply the children of the elite. We need to turn them into technical schools. We need to basically give up on education and substitute these places as institutions that are largely involved in training. So I think this is part of a policy. This is just one element, the disinvestment financially. It's just one element of a larger policy that is incredibly geared to reproducing modes of inequality and wealth and income and power that have no use whatsoever for the public university or public schools, for that matter.
So just in closing, so that we have some sense of optimism, I expressed it earlier with the Occupy movement, do you think that there is an awakening here?
Absolutely. It's not enough to simply engage in a discourse of critique. I mean, there has to be a discourse of possibility. And I think that what we see with the Occupy movements all over the country are young people who are all of a sudden saying, we're going to change the conversation. Sorry, you know, we're not going to use the old terms. We're not going to use the old language. We're not going to simply frame our arguments in terms of access. That what we're really talking about now is reclaiming democracy in a way that matters, in which, you know, questions of equality and questions of justice and questions of possibility in the future are going to be opened up not just for young people, for all people. And that's not just simply about reform. That's about transformation. And the real key now is if young people can not only begin to focus their demands, but actually begin to articulate what they're doing and move away from simply occupations to simply social movements and demonstrations that are not only national, but join up internationally with youth all over the world who are engaged in, you know, what I would call very similar struggles.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Henry Giroux.
Oh, my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously taught at Boston University and Penn State University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, and The University in Change, Confronting the Military, Industrial, Academic Complex. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we were looking into the commander-in-chief debate as it was billed, the Republican candidate, presidential candidates talking on national security. David Rothkopf, who is the author of Running the World, the inside story of the National Security Council and the architects of American power, somebody that really has studied national security issues and the kind of people that end up running our national security. He, of course, was appalled by the quality of these candidates. Ironically, of course, the ones that have some government experience are preferable to the Herman Cains and the Rick Perrys, who are woefully ignorant and dangerously delusional. But in general, he sort of suggested that at the end of the day, it looks like Romney is going to be the one. And indeed, Romney's gratuitous and endless attacks on Obama, he thought, indicated the real issue is that Obama is actually quite successful on foreign policy, and that Romney really, if he ever got the nomination, that's the last thing that he'd want to talk about, because his qualifications are so lacking. But that didn't stop him from wanting to go to war against Iran. And we talked about that possibility, given that it's still an unsettled situation there and something could happen before the elections. I try to pin him down on that. Then we talk with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under President Johnson and Nixon. He resigned over the bombing of Cambodia. He is somebody that really does know the national security from the inside, and he was much less restrained in his critique. He thinks these people are absolute ignoramuses, and in general, the Republican Party has become captured by these isolationist religious fanatics, with the exception of Ron Paul, who represents some of the more traditional strains of republicanism, meaning that they actually believe in the Constitution and the rule of law and don't want to go and around and fight wars anywhere, pay any price, etc., and torture anybody. It was a pretty dismal display, obviously, and the sad thing is that one of these clowns might actually get elected. That's where it really gets appalling, and frankly, given the state of the economy, the great irony, of course, is that for all of Obama's success in foreign policy, it may not end up counting because of the dire state of the economy. And of course, if he does actually, or if the Israelis attack Iran, then we have $10 a gallon gasoline and it's all over. Then finally, we talked with Henry Giroux, the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, the University in Change, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. This is a new take on the Penn State scandal, in as much as Henry Giroux held an endowed chair at Penn State and was able to talk about the corporatization of these public universities and how the students have become pawns in preparing themselves for a kind of corporate world and not for a broader education that gives them ethical values and a moral compass. Of course, watching the display of demonstrating the other night was pretty depressing compared to the kids up in Berkeley who are getting their heads cracked protesting for the right reasons as opposed to the wrong reasons. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.